the demand that he do something responsible to someone else with his entire body. Rome says of her patient, while he had a very sensitive need for his wife's sexual compliance, all desire left him whenever his wife indicated any sexual drive. We can look at this as the refusal of the impersonal, instrumental species role. But it is a refusal based in insecurity, when one is called upon to perform. Remember we said, with Rank, that a major characteristic of neurosis was seeing the world as it is, in all its superordinancy, power, overwhelmingness. The fetishist must feel the truth of his helplessness vis-à-vis the ponderous object and the task he has to perform. He is not securely enough programmed neurally by solid repressions and body ego to be able to falsify his real situation and hence act his animal role with indifference. The object must be overwhelming in its massiveness of hair, pendulous breasts, buttocks, and stomach. What attitude to take toward all this thingness when one feels so empty in himself? One of the reasons that the fetish object is itself so splendid and fascinating to the fetishist must be that he transfers to it the awesomeness of the other human presence. The fetish is then the manageable miracle, while the partner is not. The result is that the fetish becomes supercharged with a halo-like effect. Rome's patient saw things in their pristineness and never got over the effect. The patient's earliest recollection was of his mother washing her hair. When drying her hair in the sun, she would throw it over her face. He was both fascinated and horrified at not being able to see her face, and relieved when it was again visible. Her hair combings held a great fascination for him. On one level, we might understand this as expressing the anxiety of the child that the most personal and human part of the object, the face, can be eclipsed by the animal hair. But the whole feeling of the scene is one of awesomeness at the miracle of the created object. Most of us manage to get over the hypnotic quality of natural objects, and we do it, I think, in two related ways. One is by achieving a sense of our own power, and so establishing a kind of balance between ourselves and the world. We can then ply our desires on the object without being thrown off balance by them. But a second thing must also be done. Desire itself has to be fetishized. We cannot relate to the total object as it is, and thus we need standardized definitions of sexual attractiveness. These we get in the form of cues that serve to cut the object down to manageable size. We look at the breast or the black underwear, which allow us not really to have to take account of the total person we are relating to. In these two ways, we strip the partner of awesomeness and power, and so overcome our general helplessness in the face of her. One of Greenacre's patients conveys the problem perfectly. If he continued to see the girl, she would become increasingly repulsive to him, especially as his attention seemed inevitably focused on her body orifices. Even the pores of her skin began to be too conspicuous, to loom larger and become repellent. Gradually he found, too, that he could be more successful if he approached a girl from the rear, and did not have to be visually or tactually too aware of the difference between them. I think here, too, of Rousseau's famous account of his repulsion from the breathtaking Venetian whore, when he noticed a slight imperfection on her breast. When the overwhelming object cannot be shrunken as a straightforward vehicle of desire, it could become repulsive because its animal qualities become disengaged from it and begin to loom larger and larger. This, I think, might explain the paradox that the fetishist is overwhelmed by the awesomeness of the object, the superordinancy of it, and yet finds it repulsive in its animality. The foot only becomes a problem in itself as a paradigm of ugliness, when we cannot fuse it into the body under the secure rush of our own desire and will. Otherwise, it is a neutral part of an attractive woman. The fetishist's difficulty, then, is like the child's exactly, the inability to master pragmatic action situations with the requisite equanimity. I think this helps explain, too, why the typical phallic narcissist, the Don Juan character, often takes any object, ugly or beautiful, that comes along, with the same unconcern. He does not really take account of it in its total personal qualities. Note. This brings up the long-standing problem of why so few females are fetishists, a problem that has been solved by Greenacre and Boss. Their point is that the male, in order to fulfill his species role, has to perform the sexual act. For this, he needs secure self-powers, and also cues to arouse and channelize his desires. In this sense, the male is naturally and inevitably a fetishist of some kind and degree. The less self-power, the more terror of the looming female body, the more fetish narrowness and symbolism is necessary. The female does not have this problem because her role is passive. We might say that her fetishism is absorbed in the surrender of her body. As Boss says, women who shrink at the physical aspect of love, at the concreteness of the partner, can simply react with total frigidity. Sexual Perversions, pages 53 and 54. Or, as Greenacre observed as well, the sense of failure due to frigidity in the female is softened by the possibility of concealment. Further Considerations, page 188. Note, frigidity can be covered up to a degree which is not possible with disturbances of potency in the man. Further Notes, page 192. Also, the woman, in her passive, submissive role, often gets her security by identifying with the power of the male. This overcomes the problem of vulnerability by receiving delegated powers, both of the penis itself and of the cultural worldview. But the male fetishist is precisely the one who does not have secure delegated powers from any source and cannot get them by passive submission to the female. Compare Greenacre, Certain Relationships, page 95. We might sum this all up by saying that the frigid woman is one who submits but is not convinced that she is safe in the power of the male. She does not need to fetishize anything, as she does not have to perform an act. The impotent male is also not convinced that he is safe, but it does not suffice for him to lie passively in order to fulfill his species role. He creates the fetish, then, as a locus of denial power, so that he can perform the act. The woman denies with her whole body. Using an artfully apt term of von Gepsidel's, we would say that frigidity is the woman's form of passive auto-fetishism. Compare Boss, Sexual Perversions, page 53. End of note. All perversions, then, can truly be seen as private religions, as attempts to heroically transcend the human condition and to achieve some kind of satisfaction in that condition. That is why perverts are forever saying how superior and life-enhancing their particular approach is, how they cannot understand why anyone would not prefer it. It is the same sentiment that animates all true believers, the trumpeting of who is the true hero and what is the only genuine path to eternal glory. At this point, perversions and so-called normality meet. There is no way to experience all of life. Each person must close off large portions of it, must partialize, as Rank put it, in order to avoid being overwhelmed. There is no way to surely avoid and transcend death, for all organisms perish. The biggest, warmest, most secure, courageous spirits can still only bite off pieces of the world. The smallest, meanest, most frightened ones merely bite off the smallest possible pieces. I recall the episode of the illustrious Immanuel Kant, when a glass was broken at one of his gatherings. How carefully he weighed the alternatives for a perfect place in the garden, where the fragments could safely be buried, so that no one would be injured by them accidentally. Even our greatest spirits must indulge in the fetishist's magical ritual drama to banish accident because of animal vulnerability. The naturalness of sadomasochism. Although there is nothing new to say on this problem, with all the vast writings that have covered it, I want to again stress the naturalness of these perversions. Sadism and masochism seem like frighteningly technical ideas, secrets about the inner recesses of man, only fully revealed to practicing psychoanalysts. Even more than that, they seem like rare and grotesque aberrations of normal human conduct. Both these suppositions are false. Masochism comes naturally to man, as we have seen again and again in these pages. Man is naturally humble, naturally grateful, naturally guilty, naturally transcended, naturally a sufferer. He is small, pitiful, weak, a passive taker, who tucks himself naturally in a beyond of superior, awesome, all-embracing power. Sadism, likewise, is the natural activity of the creature, the drive toward experience, mastery, pleasure, the need to take from the world what it needs in order to increase itself and thrive. What is more, a human creature who has to forget himself, resolve his own painful inner contradictions. The hyphenated word sadomasochism expresses a natural complementary of polar opposites. No weakness without intensive focus of power, and no use of power without falling back on a secure merger with a larger source of power. Sadomasochism, then, reflects the general human condition, the daily lives of most people. It reflects man living by the nature of the world and his own nature as it has been given to him. Actually, then, it reflects normal mental health. Do we wonder, for example, that rape is on the increase in today's confused world? People feel more and more powerless. How can they express their energies, get things more in balance between overwhelming input and feeble output? Rape gives a feeling of personal power in the ability to cause pain, to totally manipulate and dominate another creature. The autocratic ruler, as Canetti so well observes, gets the ultimate in the experience of domination and control by turning all persons into animals and treating them as chattels. The rapist gets the same kind of satisfaction in what seems a perfectly natural way. There are very few situations in life in which people can get a sense of the perfect appropriateness of their energies, the quickened vitality that comes when we prove that our animal bodies have the requisite power to secure their dominion in this world, or at least a living segment of it. Note: this explains, too, the naturalness of the connection between sadism and sexuality, without putting them on an instinctive basis. They represent a mutually reinforcing sense of appropriate power, of heightened vitality. Why, for example, does a boy masturbate with fantasies on such a gory story as The Pit and the Pendulum? Greenacre, Certain Relationships, page 81. We have to imagine that the fantasy gives him a sense of power that the masturbation reinforces. The experience is a denial of impotence and vulnerability. It is much more than a simple sexual experience. It is much less than an expression of gratuitous destructive drives. Most people secretly respond to sadomasochistic fantasies, not because everyone is instinctively perverse, but because these fantasies do represent the perfect appropriateness of our energies, as well as our limitations as animal organisms. No higher satisfaction is possible for us than to dominate entirely a sector of the world, or to give in to the powers of nature by surrendering ourselves completely. Very fittingly, these fantasies usually take place when people are having trouble with the stress of symbolic affairs of the everyday world. And one may wonder why, at a meeting concerning business or academic strategy, he can't shut out images from Louis Bunuel's Belle de Jour. End of note. Have we always been puzzled by how willingly the masochist experiences pain? Well, for one thing, pain calls the body to the forefront of experience. It puts the person back into the center of things forcefully as a feeling animal. It is thus a natural complement to sadism. Both are techniques for experiencing forceful self-feeling, now in outer-directed action, now in passive suffering. Both give intensity in the place of vagueness and emptiness. Furthermore, to experience pain is to use it with the possibility of controlling it and triumphing over it. As Irving Bieber argued in his important paper, the masochist doesn't want pain. He wants to be able to identify its source, localize it, and so control it. Masochism is thus a way of taking the anxiety of life and death and the overwhelming terror of existence and congealing them into a small dosage. One then experiences pain from the terrifying power and yet lives through it without experiencing the ultimate threat of annihilation and death. As Zilborg so penetratingly observed, the sadomasochistic combination is the perfect formula for transmuting the fear of death. Rank called masochism the small sacrifice, the lighter punishment, the placation that allows one to avoid the arch-evil of death. When applied to sexuality, masochism is thus a way of taking suffering and pain, which in the last analysis are symbols of death, and transmuting them into desired sources of pleasure. As Henry Hart also observes so well, this is a way of taking self-administered homeopathic doses. The ego controls total pain, total defeat, and total humiliation by experiencing them in small doses as a sort of vaccination. From still another point of view, then, we see the fascinating ingenuity of the perversions, the turning of pain, the symbol of death, into ecstasy and the experience of more life. Note: Boss assigns an even more creative intent to sadomasochism, at least in some of its forms. See pages 104 and following. I don't know how far to follow his generalizations on the basis of the few cases he cites. And I am a little uncomfortable with what seems to be his inclination to accept his patients' rationalizations as really ideal motives. I think this has to be weighed more carefully. End of note. But again, the limits of the ingenuity of perversion are obvious. If you fix the terror of life and death magically on one person as the source of pain, you control that terror. But you also overinflate that person. This is a private religion that makes believe too much and so humiliates the masochist by placing him in the power of another person. No wonder sadomasochism is ultimately belittling, a hothouse drama of control and transcendence played by pint-sized characters. All heroism is relative to some kind of beyond. The question is, which kind? This question reminds us of something we discussed earlier, the problem of two limited beyonds. From this point of view, perversions are merely a demonstration of the severe limitation of the beyonds one chooses for his drama of heroic apotheosis. The sadomasochist is someone who plays out his drama of heroism vis-à-vis one person only. He is exercising his two ontological motives, eros and agape, on the love object alone. On the one hand, he is using that object to expand his sense of his own fullness and power. On the other, giving vent to his need to let go, abandon his will, find peace and fulfillment by a total merger with something beyond him. Rome's patient showed perfectly this shrinkage of a cosmic problem to the single partner. In an attempt to relieve his severe tension, he struggled between the wish to be a dominant male, aggressive and sadistic toward his wife, and the desire to give up his masculinity, be castrated by his wife, and thus return to a state of impotence, passivity, and helplessness. How easy it would be if we could satisfy the yearnings of the whole human condition safely in the bedroom of our cottage. As Rank put it, we want the partner to be like God, all-powerful to support our desires, and all-embracing to merge our desires into. But this is impossible. If, then, sadomasochism reflects the human condition, the acting out of our twin ontological motives, we can truly talk about honest masochism, or mature masochism, exactly as Rank did in his unusual discussion in Beyond Psychology. It was one of Freud's limitations that he could not quite push his thought to this kind of conclusion, even though he brushed it repeatedly. He was so impressed by the intensity, depth, and universality of sadism and masochism that he termed them instincts. He saw truly that these drives went right to the heart of the human creature. But he drew a pessimistic conclusion, lamenting the fact that mankind could not get rid of these drives. Again, he was stuck with his instinct theory, which made him see these drives as remnants of an evolutionary condition, and as tied to specific sexual appetites. Rank, who saw more truly, could transform sadism and masochism from clinically negative to humanly positive things. The maturity of masochism, then, would depend on the object toward which it was directed, on how much in possession of himself the mature masochist was. In Rank's view, a person would be neurotic not because he was masochistic, but because he was not really submissive, but only wanted to make believe that he was. Let us dwell on this type of failure briefly, because it sums up the whole problem of mental illness that we have broached. Mental illness as failed heroics. One very interesting and consistent conclusion emerges from our overview of mental illness. That Adler was right to say that the mentally ill all have a basic problem of courage. They cannot assume responsibility for their own independent lives. They are hyper-fearful of life and death. From this vantage point, the theory of mental illness is really a general theory of the failures of death transcendence. The avoidance of life and the terror of death become enmeshed in the personality to such an extent that it is crippled, unable to exercise the normal cultural heroism of other members of the society. The result is that the person cannot permit himself the routine heroic self-expansion, nor the easy yielding to the superordinate cultural worldview that other members can. This is why he becomes a burden on others in some way. Mental illness, then, is also a way of talking about those people who burden others with their hyper-fears of life and death, their own failed heroics. As we have seen, the depressed person is one who has embedded himself so comfortably in the powers and protection of others that he has forfeited his own life. As Adler taught us long ago, the people around the depressed person have to pay for it. Guilt, self-torture, and accusations are also ways of coercing others. What is more coercive than the magical transference of the schizophrenic, which reflects so excellently the failure of courage? Or paranoia, where the person is so weak and so alone that he creates imaginary objects of hatred in order to have any relationship at all. We have to consent to be hated in order that the paranoid can feel some small measure of vitality. This is the ultimate of laying one's trip on someone else. It is truly a trip through life and towards death that weak and frightened people lay especially hard upon others. The point is that we are coerced by the magical transference and the paranoia. And they may not be our problems. Note. Nowhere is this clearer than in Waite's highly researched and carefully thought-out paper on Hitler. Adolf Hitler's Guilt Feelings, Journal of Interdisciplinary History, 1971, 1, No. 2, 229-249, in which he argues that 6 million Jews were sacrificed to Hitler's personal sense of unworthiness and hypervulnerability of the body to filth and decay. So great were Hitler's anxieties about these things, so crippled was he psychically, that he seems to have had to develop a unique perversion to deal with them, to triumph over them. Hitler gained sexual satisfaction by having a young woman, as much younger than he, as his mother was younger than his father, squat over him to urinate or defecate on his head. Ibid, page 234. This was his private religion, his personal transcendence of his anxiety, the hyper-experience and resolution of it. This was a personal trip that he laid not only on the Jews and the German nation, but directly on his mistresses. It is highly significant that each of them committed suicide or tried to do so, and more than a simple coincidence. It might very possibly be that they could not stand the burden of his perversion. The whole of it was on them. It was theirs to live with, not in itself as a simple and disgusting physical act, but in its shattering absurdity and massive incongruity with Hitler's public role. The man who was the object of all social worship, the hope of Germany and the world, the victor over evil and filth, is the same one who will, in an hour, plead with you in private to be nice to him with the fullness of your excretions. I would say that this discordance between private and public aesthetics is possibly too much to bear, unless one can get some kind of commanding height or vantage point from which to mock it or otherwise dismiss it, say as a prostitute would, by considering her client a simple pervert, an inferior form of life. End of note. In the specific perversions, we see this coercion in an almost pure culture, where it becomes negation of ourselves as whole persons. The reason women object to perverse relationships and are offended at the artificial aid that the fetishist uses is precisely that it denies their existence as whole persons, or as persons at all. What links all the perversions is the inability to be a responsible human animal. Erich Fromm had already well described masochism as an attempt to get rid of the burden of freedom. Clinically, we find that some people are so weak in the face of responsibility that they even fear the freedom of being in a good state of health and vigor, as Bieber reminded us. In the most extreme perversion, necrophilia, we see the most extreme fear of life and of persons, as Fromm has described. One of Brill's patients was so afraid of corpses that when he overcame this fear, he became a necrophile, because he was fascinated by his new won freedom. We might say that he used necrophilia as his heroics, and that undertaker's parlors were the stage for his drama of apotheosis. Corpses are perfect in their helplessness. They can't possibly hurt you or disgrace you. You don't have to worry about their safety or their responses. Baucis described a coprophiliac whose existence was so shrunken that he could find creative heroics only in the products of the rectum. Here we see perfectly the terror of the species role, the inability to relate to the body of the sexual partner. In this patient they are so great that they risk cutting him off entirely from expressing his desires in an interpersonal relationship. He is, in effect, saved by feces and by his ingenious rationalization that they are the true source of life. Little does it matter to him that the needs of his particular heroics have reduced his wife to nothing more than a rectum. Nothing could be more graphic than the perversions in showing how fear and weakness lead to unlived life and what crippled heroics result. Strauss goes so far as to connect necrophilia with miserliness and involutional depression, as part of the same problem of the general retreat from life. We have no argument with this formulation. At this time, with our sure theoretical understanding, we can skip lightly and almost anecdotally over the whole spectrum of mental illness and perversion without much risk. They all refer to the terror of the human condition in people who can't bear up under it. Precisely at this point, our discussion of the perversions as failed heroics once again and finally makes a circle on the whole problem of human nature in its ideal dimensions. Heroism is, after all, an ideal matter. The problem of mental illness since Kierkegaard and through Scheller, Hawking, Jung, Fromm, and many others has been inseparable from the problem of idolatry. In what cosmology is one going to perform his heroics? If, as we have argued, even the strongest person has to exercise his agape motive, has to lay the burden of his life somewhere beyond him, then we are brought once again to the great questions. What is the highest reality, the true ideal, the really great adventure? What kind of heroism is called for? In what kind of drama? Submission to what kind of God? The religious geniuses of history have argued that to be really submissive means to be submissive to the highest power, the true infinity and absolute, and not to any human substitutes, lovers, leaders, nation-states. From this point of view, the problem of mental illness is one of not knowing what kind of heroics one is practicing, or not being able, once one does know, to broaden one's heroics from their crippling narrowness. Paradoxical as it may sound, mental illness is thus a matter of weakness and stupidity. It reflects ignorance about how one is going about satisfying his twin ontological motives. The desire to affirm oneself and to yield oneself are, after all, very neutral. We can choose any path for them, any object, any level of heroics. The suffering and the evil that stems from these motives are not a consequence of the nature of the motives themselves, but of our stupidity about satisfying them. This is the deeper meaning of one of Rank's insights, which otherwise would seem flippant. In a letter of 1937 he wrote, "Suddenly, while I was resting in bed, it occurred to me what really was or is beyond psychology. You know what? Stupidity. All that complicated and elaborate explanation of human behavior is nothing but an attempt to give a meaning to one of the most powerful motives of behavior, namely, stupidity. I began to think that it is even more powerful than badness, meanness, because many actions or reactions that appear mean are simply stupid, and even calling them bad is a justification." Finally, then, we can see how truly inseparable are the domains of psychiatry and religion, as they both deal with human nature and the ultimate meaning of life. To leave behind stupidity is to become aware of life as a problem of heroics, which inevitably becomes a reflection about what life ought to be in its ideal dimensions. From this point of view, we can see that the perversions of private religions are not false in comparison to true religions. They are simply less expansive, less humanly noble and responsible. All living organisms are condemned to perversity, to the narrowness of being mere fragments of a larger totality that overwhelms them, which they cannot understand or truly cope with, yet must still live and struggle in. We still must ask, then, in the spirit of the wise old Epictetus, what kind of perversity is fitting for man? Note: I cannot leave this chapter without calling attention to one of the richest little essays on the perversions that I have yet come upon. Too late to discuss here, unfortunately, but tying into and deepening these views in the most suggestive and imaginative ways. Avery D. Weissman's Self-Destruction and Sexual Perversion in Essays in Self-Destruction, edited by E. S. Schneidman, New York, Science House, 1967. Note especially the case of the patient whose mother had given her the message, "If you have sex, you will jeopardize your whole life." The result was that the patient hit upon the technique of half-strangling or half-suffocating herself in order to be able to experience orgasm. In other words, if she paid the price of almost dying, she could have pleasure without crushing guilt. To be a victim in the sexual act became the fetish that permitted it to take place. All of Weissman's patients had an image of reality and death that was medieval. They saw the world as evil, as overwhelmingly dangerous. They equated disease, defeat, and depravity just like medieval penitents. And like them, too, they had to become victims in order to deserve to remain alive, to buy off death. Weissman calls them aptly virginal romantics, who cannot stand the blatancy of physical reality and seek to transform it into something more idealized by means of the perversion. End of note. Part 3. Retrospect and Conclusion. The Dilemmas of Heroism. Chapter 11. Psychology and Religion. What is the heroic individual? If there is any science man really needs, it is the one I teach, of how to occupy properly that place in creation that is assigned to man, and how to learn from it what one must be in order to be a man. Immanuel Kant. When we are young, we are often puzzled by the fact that each person we admire seems to have a different version of what life ought to be, what a good man is, how to live, and so on. If we are especially sensitive, it seems more than puzzling. It is disheartening. What most people usually do is to follow one person's ideas and then another's, depending on who looms largest on one's horizon at the time. The one with the deepest voice, the strongest appearance, the most authority and success, is usually the one who gets our momentary allegiance, and we try to pattern our ideals after him. But as life goes on, we get a perspective on this, and all these different versions of truth become a little pathetic. Each person thinks that he has the formula for triumphing over life's limitations, and knows with authority what it means to be a man, and he usually tries to win a following for his particular patent. Today, we know that people try so hard to win converts for their point of view, because it is more than merely an outlook on life. It is an immortality formula. Not everyone, of course, has the authority of Kant speaking the words we have used in our epigraph to this chapter. But in matters of immortality, everyone has the same self-righteous conviction. The thing seems perverse because each diametrically opposed view is put forth with the same maddening certainty, and authorities who are equally unimpeachable hold opposite views. Take, for example, Freud's seasoned thoughts on human nature, and his idea of where he stood on the pyramid of struggling mankind. I have found little that is good about human beings on the whole. In my experience, most of them are trash, no matter whether they publicly subscribe to this or that ethical doctrine or none at all. If we are to talk of ethics, I subscribe to a high ideal from which most of the human beings I have come across depart most lamentably. When perhaps the greatest psychologist who ever lived lets drop the stock phrase, in my experience, it has the authority of a papal bull during medieval times. Of course, he also implies that if most people are trash, some aren't, and we can surmise who is one of the few exceptions. We are reminded of those once popular books on eugenics that always carried a handsome frontispiece photograph of the author beaming his vitality and personality as the ideal type for the book's argument. As we would expect, Freud's self-evaluation would hardly be agreed upon by everyone. Almost each of his major dissenting disciples could find something to look down upon him for, with a certain condescending pity. Wilhelm Reich once remarked that Freud was caught in the psychoanalytic movement, trapped by his disciples and his own creation, that his very cancer was the result of being shut in upon himself, unable to speak as a free agent. There's our problem again, you see. Reich's judgment would have carried more authority if it had come from a god instead of from a man who was even more caught up in his own movement, and who was more decisively and ignominiously undone by it. Jung, too, thought Freud had great limitations, but he saw these limitations as a necessary part of Freud's daimon, of his genius and peculiar message. But maybe this understanding was actually a reflection of Jung's own demonic drivenness into alchemy, of the almost shamanistic quality of his inner life. No less a student of man than Erich Fromm has written the bitterest lines on Jung, denouncing him as an enemy of science. Pity the layman scurrying under the feet of all these giants dropping their weighty pronunciamentos on one another. I haven't even mentioned Rank's powerful views on Freud's limitations. In Rank's system of thought, the most generous judgment that might probably be made about Freud's limitations was that he shared the human weakness of the neurotic. He lacked the capacity for illusion, for a creative myth about the possibilities of creation. He saw things too realistically, without their aura of miracle and infinite possibility. The only illusion he allowed himself was that of his own science, and such a source is bound to be a shaky support, because it comes from one's own energies and not from a powerful beyond. This is the problem of the artist, generally, that he creates his own new meanings and must in turn be sustained by them. The dialogue is too inverted to be secure, and hence Freud's lifelong ambivalence about the value of posterity and fame, the security of the whole panorama of evolution. We touched on all these questions in our comparison of Freud and Kierkegaard, and now we are back to it. One can only talk about an ideal human character from a perspective of absolute transcendence. Kierkegaard would say that Freud still had pride, that he lacked the creature consciousness of the truly analyzed man, that he had not fully served his apprenticeship in the school of anxiety. In Kierkegaard's understanding of man, the causa sui project is the Oedipus complex, and in order to be a man, one has to abandon it completely. From this point of view, Freud still had not analyzed away his Oedipus complex, no matter how much he and the early psychoanalysts prided themselves that they had. He could not yield emotionally to superordinate power, or conceptually to the transcendental dimension. He lived still wholly in the dimension of the visible world, and was limited by what was possible in that dimension only. Therefore, all his meanings had to come from that dimension. Kierkegaard had his own formula for what it means to be a man. He put it forth in those superb pages wherein he describes what he calls the knight of faith. This figure is the man who lives in faith, who has given over the meaning of life to his creator, and who lives centered on the energies of his maker. He accepts whatever happens in this visible dimension without complaint, lives his life as a duty, faces his death without a qualm. No pettiness is so petty that it threatens his meanings. No task is too frightening to be beyond his courage. He is fully in the world on its terms and wholly beyond the world in his trust in the invisible dimension. It is very much the old pietistic ideal that was lived by Kant's parents. The great strength of such an ideal is that it allows one to be open, generous, courageous, to touch others' lives and enrich them and open them in turn. As the knight of faith has no fear of life and death trip to lay on to others, he does not cause them to shrink back upon themselves. He does not coerce or manipulate them. The knight of faith, then, represents what we might call an ideal of mental health, the continuing openness of life out of the death throes of dread. But in these abstract terms, the ideal of the knight of faith is surely one of the most beautiful and challenging ideals ever put forth by man. It is contained in most religions in one form or another, although no one, I think, has described it at length with such talent as Kierkegaard. Like all ideals, it is a creative illusion, meant to lead men on, and leading men on is not the easiest thing. As Kierkegaard said, faith is the hardest thing. He placed himself between belief and faith, unable to make the jump. The jump doesn't depend on man after all. There's the rub. Faith is a matter of grace. As Tillich later put it, religion is first an open hand to receive gifts, grace, and then a closed hand to give them. One cannot give the gifts of the knight of faith without first being dubbed a knight by some higher majesty. The point I am driving at is that if we take Kierkegaard's life as a believing Christian and place it against Freud's as an agnostic, there is no balance sheet to draw. Who was to tally up which one caused others to shrink up more or to expand more fully? For every shortcoming that we can point to in Freud, we can find a corresponding one in Kierkegaard. If Freud can be said to have erred on the side of the visible, then Kierkegaard can surely be said to have equally erred on the side of the invisible. He turned away from life partly from his fear of life. He embraced death more easily because he had failed in life. His own life was not a voluntary sacrifice undertaken in free will, but a pathetically driven sacrifice. He did not live in the categories in which he thought. I am talking matter-of-factly about some of the surest giants in the history of humanity, only to say that in the game of life and death, no one stands taller than any other, unless it be a true saint, and only to conclude that sainthood itself is a matter of grace and not of human effort. My point is that for man, not everything is possible. What is there to choose between religious creatureliness and scientific creatureliness? The most one can achieve is a certain relaxedness, an openness to experience that makes him less of a driven burden on others. And a lot of this depends on how much talent he has, how much of a daimon is driving him. It is easier to lay down light burdens than heavy ones. How does a man create from all his living energies a system of thought as Freud did, a system directed wholly to the problems of this world, and then just give it up to the invisible one? How, in other words, can one be a saint and still organize scientific movements of world historical importance? How does one lean on God and give over everything to Him and still stand on his own feet as a passionate human being? These are not rhetorical questions. They are real ones that go right to the heart of the problem of how to be a man, a problem that no one can satisfactorily advise anyone else on, as the wise William James knew. The whole thing is loaded with ambiguity impossible to resolve. As James said, each person sums up a whole range of very personal experiences, so that his life is a very unique problem, needing very individual kinds of solutions. Kierkegaard had said that same thing when he answered those who objected to his lifestyle. He said it was singular because it was the one singularity designed to be what he needed in order to live. It is as simple and as final as that. James, again, knew how difficult it was to live astride both worlds, the visible and the invisible. One tended to pull you away from the other. One of his favorite precepts, which he often repeated, was, "Son of man, stand upon your own feet so that I may speak with you." If men lean too much on God, they don't accomplish what they have to in this world on their own powers. In order to do anything, one must first be a man, apart from everything else. This throws the whole splendid ideal of sainthood into doubt, because there are many ways of being a good man. Was Norman Bethune any less a saint than Vincent de Paul? That, I suppose, is another way of saying that in this world each organism lives to be consumed by its own energies, and those that are consumed with the most relentlessness and burn with the brightest flame seem to serve the purposes of nature best, so far as accomplishing anything on this planet is concerned. It is another way, too, with Rank, of talking about the priority of the irrational life force that uses organismic forms only to consume them. The impossible heroism. In the light of all this ambiguity, we can take an understanding look at some of the modern prophets on human nature. I have been saying that a man cannot evolve beyond his character, that he is stuck with it. Goethe said that a man cannot get rid of his nature, even if he throws it away, to which we can add, even if he tries to throw it to God. Now it is time to see that if a man cannot evolve beyond his character, he surely can't evolve without character. This brings up one of the great debates in contemporary thought. If we talk about the irrational life force living the limitations of organisms, we are not going to take the next step and get carried away into abstractions that are so popular today. Abstractions in which the life force suddenly and miraculously seems to emerge from nature without any limits. I am referring, of course, to the new propheticism of people like Marcuse, Brown, and so many others on what man may achieve, what it really means to be a man. I promised at the beginning of this book to linger a bit on the details of this problem, and now is the time for it. Take Norman Brown's Life Against Death. Rarely does a work of this brilliance appear. Rarely does a book so full of closely reasoned argument, a very threatening argument, achieve such popularity. But like most other foundation-shaking messages, this one is popular for all the wrong reasons. It is prized not for its shattering revelations on death and anality, but for its wholly non-sequitur conclusions, for its plea for the unrepressed life, the resurrection of the body as a seat of primary pleasure, the abolition of shame and guilt. Brown concludes that mankind can only transcend the terrible toll that the fear of death takes if it lives the body fully and does not allow any unlived life to poison existence, to sap pleasure, and to leave a residue of regret. If mankind would do this, says Brown, then the fear of death will no longer drive it to folly, waste, and destruction. Men will have their apotheosis in eternity by living fully in the now of experience. The enemy of mankind is basic repression, the denial of throbbing physical life, and the specter of death. The prophetic message is for the wholly unrepressed life, which would bring into birth a new man. A few lines of Brown's own words give us his key message. If we can imagine an unrepressed man, a man strong enough to live and therefore strong enough to die, and therefore what no man has ever been, an individual, such a man would have overcome guilt and anxiety. In such a man would be fulfilled on earth the mystic hope of Christianity, the resurrection of the body in a form, as Luther said, free from death and filth. With such a transfigured body, the human soul can be reconciled, and the human ego become once more what it was designed to be in the first place, a body ego, and the surface of a body. The human ego would have to become strong enough to die, and strong enough to set aside guilt. Full psychoanalytic consciousness would be strong enough to cancel the debt of guilt by deriving it from infantile fantasy. What is one to say about such an eloquent program when it flies in the face of everything we know about man and most of what Brown himself has written about human character in the preceding almost 300 pages? These few lines contain fallacies so obvious that one is shocked that a thinker of Brown's power could even let them linger in his mind, much less put them down as reasoned arguments. Once again, and always, we are back to basic things that we have not shouted loud enough from the rooftops, or printed in big enough block letters. Guilt is not a result of infantile fantasy, but of self-conscious adult reality. There is no strength that can overcome guilt, unless it be the strength of a god, and there is no way to overcome creature anxiety, unless one is a god and not a creature. The child denies the reality of his world as miracle and as terror. That's all there is to it. Wherever we turn, we meet this basic fact that we must repeat one final time. Guilt is a function of real overwhelmingness, the stark majesty of the objects in the child's world. If we as adults are well dulled and armored against all this, we have only to read poets such as Thomas Traherne, Sylvia Plath, or R.L. Stevenson, who haven't blunted their receptors to raw experience. As I go on in this life day by day, I become more of a bewildered child. I cannot get used to this world, to procreation, to heredity, to sight, to hearing. The commonest things are a burthen, the prim, obliterated, polite surface of life, and the broad, bawdy, and orgiastic, or menatic foundations, form a spectacle to which no habit reconciles me. Brown's whole vision of some future man falls flat on the one failure to understand guilt. It does not derive from infantile fantasy, but from reality. In other words, and this too is crucial enough to bear stressing one final time, the child represses himself. He takes over the control of his own body as a reaction to the totality of experience, not only to his own desires. As Reich so exhaustively and definitively argued, the child's problems are existential. They refer to his total world, what bodies are for, what to do with them, what is the meaning of all this creation. Repression fulfills the vital function of allowing the child to act without anxiety, to take experience in hand and develop dependable responses to it. How could we ever get a new man without guilt and anxiety if each child, in order to become human, necessarily put limits on his own ego? There can be no birth in second innocence, because we would get a repetition of the very dynamics that Brown deplores, dynamics that rule out the possibility of the terrors of innocence. These are the necessary dynamics of humanization, of ego development. Brown plunges with both feet into Aristotelian first causes and claims to know what the human ego was designed to be in the first place, a body ego. Now, Brown is not the first to claim to see that evolution of the human animal is some kind of mishap. He has prominent predecessors like Trigent Burrow and L.L. White, and now he has to be included with them for the nonsense as well as the good things that they have written. How can we say that evolution has made a mistake with man, that the development of the forebrain, the power to symbolize, to delay experience, to bind time, was not intended by nature, and so represents a self-defeat embodied in an improbable animal? The ego, on the contrary, represents the immense broadening of experience and potential control, a step into a true kind of sub-divinity in nature. Life in the body is not all we have, if we have an ego. And the ego represents, as far as we can judge, a natural urge by the life force itself toward an expansion of experience, toward more life. If the urge toward more life is an evolutionary blunder, then we are calling into question all of creation and fitting it into the narrow mold of our own preferences about what more life ought to be. Admittedly, when evolution gave man a self, an inner symbolic world of experience, it split him in two, gave him an added burden. But this burden seems to be the price that had to be paid in order for organisms to attain more life, for the development of the life force on the furthest reach of experience and self-consciousness. Brown claims that the reunification of the ego and the body is not a dissolution but a strengthening of the human ego. But this one phrase in passing rings hollow because it is truly empty chatter that avoids facing everything we know about the ego. To talk about a new man whose ego emerges wholly with his body is to talk about a subhuman creature, not a superhuman one. The ego, in order to develop at all, must deny, must bind time, must stop the body. In other words, the kind of new man that Brown himself wants would have to have an ego in order to experience his body, which means that the ego has to disengage itself from the body and oppose it. That is another way of saying that the child must be blocked in his experience in order to be able to register that experience. If we don't stop the child, he develops very little sense of himself. He becomes an automaton, a reflex of the surface of his world, playing upon his own surface. Clinically, we have huge documentation for this character type, whom we call the psychopath. Phenomenologically, we have understood this since Dewey's Experience and Nature. Brown's whole thesis falls, then, on a twin failure. Not only on his failure to understand the real psychodynamics of guilt, but also his turning his back on how the child registers experience on his body. The need to develop in a dualistic way in order to be a rich repository of life. For a thinker of Brown's breadth and penetration, these failures are rather uncanny. And we realize them with a sense of reluctance, of unwillingness to find such glaring lapses in what is really a thinker of heroic dimensions. I am less upset when I find similar lapses in Marcuse, who is a much less daring reinterpreter of Freud, but who puts forth a similar call for a new kind of unrepressed man. On the one hand, Marcuse calls for a revolution of unrepression because he knows that it is not enough to change the structure of society in order to bring a new world into being. The psychology of man also has to be changed. But on the other hand, he admits that unrepression is impossible because there is death. The brute fact of death denies once and for all the reality of a non-repressive existence. The closing pages of his book are a realistic and regretful admission that the ego has to spread itself beyond the pleasures of the body in order for men to be men. But the dedicated social revolutionary who wants a new world and a new man more than anything else can't accept the reality that he himself sees. He still believes in the possibility of some kind of final liberation, which also rings like the hollow passing thought that it is. Marcuse even turns his back wholly on living experience and gets carried away by his abstractions. Men can die without anxiety if they know that what they love is protected from misery and oblivion by the new utopian society. As if men could ever know that, as if you and I can't be sure at any instant that our child will not be obliterated by a senseless accident, or that the whole planet will not be smashed by a gigantic meteor. Why do brilliant thinkers become so flaccid, dissipate so carelessly their own careful arguments? Probably because they see their task as a serious and gigantic one, the critique of an entire way of life, and they see themselves in an equally gigantic prophetic role, to point to a way out once and for all, in the most uncompromising terms. This is why their popularity is so great. They are prophets and simplifiers. Like Brown, Marcuse wants a sure indicator of alienation, a focal point in nature, and finds it in the ideology and fear of death. Being a true revolutionary, he wants to change this in his lifetime, wants to see a new world born. He is so committed to this fulfillment that he cannot allow himself to stop in midstream and follow out the implications of his own reservations on unrepression, his own admissions about the inevitable grip of death. Fear of death is obviously deeper than ideology. To admit this would make his whole thesis ambiguous. And what revolutionary wants that? He would have to put forth a program that is not totally revolutionary, that allows for repression, that questions what men may become, that sees how inevitably men work against their own better interests, how they must shut out life and pleasure, follow irrational hero systems, that there is a demonism in human affairs that even the greatest and most sweeping revolution cannot undo. With an admission like this, Marcuse would be an anomaly, a tragic revolutionary, and would dissipate his role as a straightforward prophet. Who can expect him to do that? There is no point in lingering on the fallacies of the revolutionaries of unrepression. One could go on and on, but everything would come back to the same basic thing, the impossibility of living without repression. No one has argued this impossibility with more authority and style than Philip Reef in his recent work, and so far as I can see, it should lay the matter to rest. He turns the whole movement on end. Repression is not falsification of the world. It is truth, the only truth that man can know, because he cannot experience everything. Reef is calling us back to basic Freudianism, to a stoical acceptance of the limits of life, the burdens of it, and of ourselves. In a particularly beautiful phrase, he puts it this way. The heaviest crosses are internal, and men make them so that, thus skeletally supported, they can bear the burden of their flesh. Under the sign of this inner cross, a certain inner distance is achieved from the infantile desire to be and have everything. Reef's point is the classical one, that in order to have a truly human existence, there must be limits. And what we call culture, or the superego, sets such limits. Culture is a compromise with life that makes human life possible. He quotes Marx's defiant revolutionary phrase, "I am nothing and should be everything." For Reef, this is the undiluted infantile unconscious speaking. Or, as I would prefer to say with Rank, the neurotic consciousness, the all or nothing of the person who cannot partialize his world. One bursts out in boundless megalomania, transcending all limits, or bogs down into wormhood like a truly worthless sinner. There is no secure ego balance to limit the intake of reality, or to fashion the output of one's own powers. If there is tragic limitation in life, there is also possibility. What we call maturity is the ability to see the two in some kind of balance into which we can fit creatively. As Reef put it, character is the restrictive shaping of possibility. It all boils down again to the fact that the prophets of unrepression simply have not understood human nature. They envisage a utopia with perfect freedom from inner constraint and from outer authority. This idea flies in the face of the fundamental dynamism of unfreedom that we have discovered in each individual, the universality of transference. This fact is hardly lost on Reef, who realizes that men need transference because they like to see their morality embodied, need some kind of points of support in the endless flux of nature. Abstractions will never do. God terms have to be exemplified. Men crave their principles incarnate in enactable characters, actual selective mediators between themselves and the polytheism of experience. This failure to push the understanding of psychodynamics to its limits is the hurdle that none of the utopians can get over. It finally vitiates their best arguments. I am thinking here, too, of Alan Harrington's tremendously effective writing on fear of death as the mainspring of human conduct. Like Brown, he pins an entirely fanciful and self-defeating thesis onto the most penetrating and damaging insights. Is fear of death the enemy? Then the cure is obvious. Abolish death. Is this fanciful? No, he answers, science is working on the problem. Admittedly, we may not be able to abolish death entirely, but we can prolong life to a great extent. Who knows how much eventually? We can envisage a utopia wherein people will have such long lives that the fear of death will drop away, and with it, the fiendish drivenness that has haunted man so humiliatingly and destructively all through his history, and now promises to bring him total self-defeat. Men will then be able to live in an eternal now of pure pleasure and peace, become truly the godlike creatures that they have the potential to be. Again, the modern utopians continue the one-sided enlightenment dream. Condorcet had already had the identical vision in 1794. A period must one day arrive when death will be nothing more than the effect either of extraordinary accidents or of the slow and gradual decay of the vital powers, and that the duration of the interval between the birth of man and his decay will have itself no assignable limit. But Choron offers a caution on this vision that goes right to the heart of it and demolishes it, that the postponement of death is not a solution to the problem of the fear of death. There still will remain the fear of dying prematurely. The small virus or the stupidest accident would deprive a man not of 90 years, but of 900, and would be then 10 times more absurd. Condorcet's failure to understand psychodynamics was forgivable, but not Harrington's today. if something is 10 times more absurd, it is 10 times more threatening. In other words, death would be hyper-fetishized as a source of danger, and men in the utopia of longevity would be even less expensive and peaceful than they are today. I see this utopia, in one way, resembling the beliefs of many primitive societies. They denied that death was the total end of experience.